You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please give a big Baltimore welcome to Cory Booker.
Oh, stop it. Y'all getting a little cruel joke here. Invite me down to speak, I feel honored, and then you have to sit me between George Soros and the governor of the darn state just to try to make me feel small. Then you parade a bunch of people before me that have given the definition of audacity. And I leaned over during this thing and I said, I know y'all aren't that trite and cliche that you think to yourself, you've got to speak about audacity, so let's get a young, rising black politician to speak about audacity. Maybe he'll throw a little hope in there for us. So I'm a little ticked off right now. But I'm going to try to do my best with what you all gave me, which is a big dose of humble pie. And therefore, I'm not going to rely on any wisdom that I have in all of my 39 years. I'm going to fall back on the people that have given me the definition of audacity. And really, I'll fall on one person. And this individual has given me a definition of audacity in three parts. And I will go rapidly, as the mayor before me, the great Mayor Dixon, told me, I have 20 minutes. I am a lawyer and a politician, used to being paid by the hour, so that 20 minutes might be a little longer, but I'll do the best I can. I was a law student and started commuting down from New Haven, Connecticut to Yale to do work and to really start my way. And I had gotten a public interest fellowship and was all turned on to take on a city and wanted to be a part of it. So Chris Rock has a joke. He says, why it's the most violent street in every city is named for the man that stood for nonviolence. So I moved on to Martin Luther King Boulevard in Newark, New Jersey, and found this tenant president who was in these buildings that were having a heck of a time. And I knocked on her door, and I told her, as she opened the door, I said, my name is Cory Booker. And almost with a, not audacity, but with an arrogance, I said, I'm from Yale Law School, ma'am, and I'm here to help you. And this tenant president, whose face looked worn from years, but her spirit jumped out of her chest like a mighty warrior, she looked at me and she said, you want to help me? And I said, yeah. And she goes, well, follow me. And she pushes past me and she marches down five flights of stairs, marches through the complexes of this big housing complex, through some drug dealers that I stood very close to her at that point, and into the middle of a street. And she wheels around and she says, tell me what you see. And I looked around and said, what? She goes, tell me what you see. And I described the high-rise projects. I described the crack house that was behind me to the left and sort of just described the neighborhood I saw. And she shook her head and she said, well, you could never help me, boy. And she turned around and started walking away. And I ran after her and I said, what are you talking about? And she goes, boy, you need to understand something. That the world you see outside of you is a reflection of what you have inside of you. And if you're one of those people who only sees darkness and despair and problems, that's all there's ever going to be. But if you're one of those people who sees hope, who sees opportunity, who sees possibilities, who sees the face of God, then you can be someone to help me. And she marched off. The first audacity, very simply, is the audacity of vision, is what you see. And Emerson tried to capture the beauty and the dignity and the poetry of what she said in a quote that he said, where he said, that which you see without of you is always a reflection of what you have within. If you see no angels, it's because you harbor none. We are here today because of a divinity of vision. We are a country that was founded like no other up until that time. We weren't founded on a theocracy where everybody prayed the same. We weren't founded on a monarchy with some kind of idea of divine right. We were the first country founded on a set of principles. Some men came together and pledged their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor, and put forth into this earth, into this air, into the spirit of America, a set of ideals. Now, my mom and my dad taught me that this nation was founded in perfect ideals, but a savagely imperfect reality. And the history of America is a history of ordinary people with extraordinary vision who made incredible sacrifices to make real on the promise of America. In every single way and in every single day, through hardships, through agony and pain, they did not stop seeing this country for what it was. The great writer, one of my favorite of all times, James Baldwin, at the end of his book, The Fire Next Time, written in the depth and the pain of the 60s. Cities were literally erupting in pain. He said at the end of the book, he goes, I know what I'm asking you is impossible, but in today's day and age, the impossible is the least I can demand. For one is, after all, emboldened by the spectacle of human history in general and Negro history in particular, for it testifies to nothing less than the perpetual achievement of the impossible in every way. This is Baldwin. Langston Hughes said it, the spirit of America. He said, America never was America to me, but I swear this oath, America will be. This is our country. People who saw America in sweatshops and factories almost chained to what they were doing, working every single day of the work, children and mothers, people in that pain saw America and were willing to organize, were willing to fight back, willing to bear assaults to see America. My hero, her statue sits on the desk. Harriet Tubman, marching from the South through swamps and bitter night, looking into the sky, trying to find the North Star. Her vision may have been obscured, but she saw America for who it was. My father, who was born to an illegitimate, as they called it back those days, to a single mother. He used to always tell me, boy, I was not poor, couldn't afford it. I was just Po, P-O, could not afford the other two letters. My dad said, Corey, I was taught at my earliest age to believe in this country, to fight for this nation. And I had great Americans that stood up for me when my mother couldn't take care of me, took me into their homes, fed me, kept me going, got me off to college when I couldn't afford it. People from this small southern town put their money together to pay for my tuition. This is the America. My father talked to me about sitting on lunch counters. He was at North Carolina Central University, a small black college, right when the sit-in movement started. Men and women, boys and girls, teenagers sitting at lunch counters being kicked and spit on, beat. My father introducing me to friends that still had scars on their bodies from those days. They did that because they saw America. Some people see obstacles. Americans see opportunities. Some people see barriers. Americans see blessings. Some people see pitfalls. America sees pools of potential. What other country could ask for tired and poor, the wretched refuse from teeming shores, and see future leaders, innovators, inventors, businessmen and women? It's America. But somewhere along the line, I worry about us. We've forgotten where we are. Carter G. Woodson, the great author, said the primary cause of human suffering is forgetfulness. People who look at themselves and forgot who they are, from whence they've come. We have no right otherwise to see exactly where we are. We're a generation that stands in a breach. We're a generation that stands in a gap between where America is and where America must go if we are to manifest ourselves. Listen to our songs. This land is your land. This land is my land. From the South Ward of Newark, New Jersey, to the inner city of Baltimore. Listen to what our very children say all over this nation. Are they not visionaries when they look up in the morning and pledge allegiance to the flag, saying boldly, we are one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all? That is a vision. That is a calling. That is a nation yearning. This country has never been a spectator sport. We are a full combat community. We don't have time for people to sit back and articulately studying and talking and describing and cursing the darkness. This nation was made by visionaries who lit lights and torches and matches so others could see their way to freedom, to hope, to possibility, to the American dream. I got elected when I was 28 years old, didn't know that much about government at all. That community of this woman, Miss Jones, an audacious visionary, they spawned my political career. Youngest person ever elected in my city. I was a reformer. I beat a guy that was in office for 16 years before me, 40 years older than me. I marched down to City Hall, ready to make a change. And quickly, the mayor of the city sent me nice little messages. I parked my car with all the other council people. I came out. I had a parking ticket. I was supposed to be able to hire 5 staff people. He wouldn't pay them. All these little messages. I tried to get votes on the city council to do reforms, and unfortunately, I could never get votes. Outvoted 8-1. I think I set a city record for being outvoted the most. I came down about budgeting and studied other cities and talked to them about how we were going to do the budget process, and found out that the city's budget wasn't even passed usually until the 12th month of the fiscal year. just a historical document. I grew frustrated. The coalition of poor, low-income tenants that elected me began to grow frustrated too. I couldn't get anything done. I began to wonder and doubt who I was and why was I there. I could be doing more, I thought to myself, as a private lawyer out in the community. I could be doing more in another job, in another position. But a lot of the people who got me elected did not give up. On the worst day, year I had been in office, the worst day, I got a call from Elaine Sewell, this amazing tenant leader in the northern part of my city. She was furious and upset. A horrible incident happened with drug dealers where they literally chased after the rental cops that were security guards and tried to light the guard booth on fire. It was a melee out there. She called the Wild Wild West and she said, "You got to do something." And I quickly retorted back to her. I said, "I can't do anything. The mayor always tells me I'm a legislator, not an administrator. I can't even get the police to do anything. I'm isolated down here. I have no power." I made all these excuses. She yelled at me. I complained back to her. We hung up the phone. I was frustrated, angry, long day, came home with a headache. I wanted to go to my apartment. I now moved into these high-rise projects, and there was Miss Jones Dagnabbit standing there in front of me. And I walked right past her. I said, "Hello, I got to go to my apartment." And she said, "Stop right there." And I said, "What?" She goes, "You don't have a hug for me?" I said, "Miss Jones, I don't have time. It's been a horrible day." She goes, "Come over here and tell Miss Jones what happened." And I marched on over to her, angry as anything, and I said, "Look." And I told her the whole story. I told her my frustrations. I told her I made calls to the police department. They weren't sending people out there. I told her all the things, and I just vented on her. And she looked at me, and she said to me, "Well, I know what you should do." I said, "You do?" And she goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, what should I do?" She said, "I know what you should do." I said, "You do? Tell me, what should I do?" She goes, "I know what you should do." I said, "Miss Jones, I don't have time to play. What should I do?" She goes, "Okay, you should do something." I said, "That's it?" And she said, "Yeah, you should do something." And I was angry as heck. I turned around. I stormed to the building. I lived on the top floor of these projects. And that elevator, I tell you right now, could always sense my mood. If I was in a good mood, having a good day, it would open up its doors. It would let me ride up. Sometimes it would turn the lights off, so we'd be riding up in the darkness. But if I was in a bad mood like today, it would be broken. And of course, the elevator was broken. I stormed up 16 flights, caught my breath at my door, holding onto the doorknob, let myself, and then I sat down. Now, I'm a guy that loves the manifestations of God, especially in prayer and worship. I've studied in ashrams in India, Vedantic thought and Hinduism. I've the only in the history of humankind, I am the only black Christian goy head of a Lubavitch Chabad house in history. It's true. It's true. If you want that story, give me another 20 minutes. But as I was sitting there next to the book that represents my faith, I turned open the Bible, and there was this passage that stared at me from Matthew that says, "You have faith the size of a mustard seed, you can move mountains." But the next part underneath it, which most people forget, it says, "Sometimes you got to fast and pray." And I took a deep breath and thought about Miss Jones and realized that she always in her life represented to me that second type of audacity, the audacity of action. She was a fighter, quite literally. This big slumlord that ran those projects took her to court once because she came after him with an umbrella and beat him up. 5'2", 70-year-old woman. So I called my aide and I said, "Buy me a tent." And he said, "A tent?" And I said, "Yes, buy me a tent." We got a tent and we set it up out at these projects where the violence had happened. Miss Sewell came over and I explained to her what I was going to do. I went over to the drug dealers and I said, "Fellas, I'm not here to fight you, but we can't let this go on anymore. This is crazy." I said to them, "I'm not going to leave here until we solve this problem." And I said, "Not only that," I said, "Fellas, I'm not going to eat any food until this is done." And then I called the press in. They thought I was some kind of suicidal maniac. And I said to them, I said, "This is the United States of America." I said, "We are the superpower on the globe. We stand for something. We cannot have places in our nation where people live in fear to even go out of their house." I said, "Interview the people that live here and put even one small piece of their daily lives on your news." And they did just that. That night I went to bed and the drug dealers kept me awake in all kind of creative ways. There was very loud music, seemed like it played all night. Fortunately, I'm kind of partial to a little bit of Tupac and Biggie a little bit. And I suddenly the next morning saw my country come out. First part of my nation that came forward was my own community. You see, Newark, we call it Brick City, and we call it Brick City because the people there are tough. They're hard, they're strong, they're enduring, they're resilient, and when they come together, there is nothing they can't accomplish. First guys that came out were guys from the community who were local security guards, correctional officers, rather, for maximum security prison in the area. And they said, son, I saw you on TV. You're not going to stand out here alone. They took positions out around my tent and began to start offering what they could do. Community leaders started coming out from other areas of the community saying, I want to stand with you too. Before I knew it, we had ministers coming out offering to fast with me and pray with me. Before I knew it, we had a mayor from a suburban town called West Orange, came down with his police officers, came all the way down to stand with me vigil through the night. As each day passed in this endeavor, more and more people came from further and further afield. Hospitals came out to do health screenings, and suddenly kids were getting the most basic services. Seniors were getting checkups. It was amazing the kind of headways we were making in simple health care. We had companies come out and set up tables and do job fairs, and we actually got people hired who had been looking for jobs, even some of the people that were allegedly out there doing drugs, people that were willing to hire ex-offenders and give them an opportunity. We had people as far away as New York City coming to be there with me, NYU students coming to sleep under the tent. This one guy, Wall Street guy, saw the hundreds now people standing out there and actually decided to send out, he must have sent out like 500 pizzas just to feed everybody, which really ticked me off because I was on a hunger strike. The 10th day, the mayor of the city, my adversary, my nemesis in many ways at that point, came out. It was a huge scene, cameras from all over the place. He came up to me. We faced each other in the middle of this huge crowd, almost like a boxing match, but there was no violence. There was no anger. I was worn down. So was he. There was only love. We embraced each other, and he turned to the crowd, pledged to build a park in that area, and pledged to make sure that he left police out there until the problem was solved. The last day, we prayed. And I'll never forget this moment, probably my favorite moment so far in my short years. We held hands and prayed. At this point, there were hundreds of people praying, not the four people on the first day. There were people from at least three or four different faiths. There were Muslims there. There were Jews there. There were Catholics there. There were Protestants and black Christians. And I heard prayers in all different kind of languages, the Spanish and Islam. We held hands, and I began in my weakened state not to hear the prayers, but I heard the calling of our community. I heard the Ethiopian saying that says when spider webs unite, they could tie up a lion. I heard the East African saying that says when sticks are in a bundle, they can't be broken. I heard the saying from Golda Meir, the Jewish saying that says when Jews are together, they are strong, but Jews with other people are invincible. I heard the saying of Martin Luther King from his letters from the Birmingham jail saying that we're all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a common garment of destiny, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And I heard the very hallmark of our nation come real, alive, textured, and beautiful, e pluribus unum. Out of the many, there is one. This is the America that I love. This is the country to which I aspire to live up to. This is the legacy that we have inherited. People don't realize this, but in our country, we are all in a common foxhole. I don't care if you live in Baltimore or Newark, in Los Angeles or San Francisco. We are in it together. Behind us, if we care to look, you can see that we've gained acres and miles of ground because of the sacrifices of others. Men and women who did not even know our names, who bled the beaches of Normandy red for us, who got on buses for freedom rights, blacks and whites together, chain whipped and beaten for us, who protested, who marched, who fought for us. They didn't know our names. They didn't know that we were even coming. But they had a dream of an America. They had a dream of a future. I don't want to wax here optimistically. I don't want to tell you that the story of my existence in public life has been rosy. I've hit the pits sometimes. I've seen it in the short time I've been mayor. And this is maybe the last and most important audacity. On my birthday just a few years ago, this season in spring, I was walking. I wasn't mayor yet in my neighborhood. Gunshots rang out. I turned around and I saw children running down a hill. I raced through the kids towards where the gunfire happening just to see a young man stumbling backwards, a teenager. He looked so young. He fell into my arms and I held him there. And I looked over his shoulder and I saw his white t-shirt filling up with red blood. I laid him on the ground and threw my hands into his chest, not knowing what to do, but just thinking if I applied pressure, maybe the blood would stop. But it seemed to come from everywhere. I started yelling at people to call an ambulance, asking people what his name was. They told me his name, and I started screaming at him, "Stay with me." He was already unconscious, and foamy blood started coming out of his mouth. Throwing my hands in his mouth, I tried to just wipe away the blood, hoping that he would breathe again. The ambulance came, pushed me out of the way, and I stood there in his blood, watching them rip open his shirt and saw the 3 gunshots in his chest and the 1 in his side. I stood there as they worked feverishly, but he was already gone. I went home that night, walked the 16 flights to my stairs, and stood there looking in the mirror, and I confess to you now, in this room full of giants, I confess to you right now, I indulged in something we should never indulge in. I started trying to scrub this blood off of my hands, and I started feeling myself be swallowed up by a blackness and an anger and a frustration. Scrubbing on my hands. The blood seemed to be gone, but I started crying into the sink, thinking I could not get my hands clean enough. I started thinking even bad thoughts about our nation. How could our country be obsessed with the death of affluent white girls that we all know their names, JonBenet Ramsey, Natalie Holloway, but black children were dying in my city every single week, and nobody knew their names. Because anger piled up inside of me as I thought about men who go away for nonviolent drug crimes and do a year's sentence but end up serving a lifetime sentence, back and forth into prison, further and further into hopelessness, further and further into lives of crimes, because we cannot open doors, treat them like the prodigal children that they are. I grew angry with my own country, with the bitterness and the division and the violence and the hatred and the bigotry. On and on it echoed in my mind as I tried to sleep in my bed that night. I got up the next morning and came down the stairs of the projects and came out into the lobby, came through the courtyard, and there was the back head of that woman, Miss Jones. And it was almost as if in that moment she reached behind her and smacked me upside her head, because all I had to do was see her. You see, I remembered in that instant a story that she told me. You see, in 2002, I was chosen, like the man before me, Martin O'Malley, to be one of Esquire magazine's 40 best and brightest in our nation. O'Malley, at that point, was a mayor doing phenomenal things that ultimately would become a blueprint for many things I'm doing in Newark, and was very worthy of the accolade. Me, in 2002, all I had done was lose an election for mayor. And I asked them why they had chosen me, and they gave me some nice platitudes. And I said to them, I said, well, let me write a story about somebody for your magazine that is truly one of the best and brightest, but would never show up in your pages. And I wrote it about Miss Jones. And in the interviewing of her, the story I recollected when I came out was she told me a story I did not know. It was the story of her son who went overseas, put on an American uniform that means something, and fought for our country, served our nation, and came back home. And during the time it was home, as she told me, she got a knock on her door. It wasn't an arrogant Yale law student. It was somebody who was crying and could not speak. And she was dragged from her home, dragged down 5 flights of stairs into the lobby, and there was her son, bleeding the lobby floor red, murdered because his identity was mistaken for someone else. She told me she fell to her knees, wailed, and could not cry. Could not stop crying. At the end of that, as she told me this story, I said to her, the only thing that could come to my mind, which was kind of stupid, you see, me and Miss Jones were 2 of the people that lived in these buildings and paid market rent to live there. She had options. I knew where she worked. I knew the money she made. She could live anywhere, but she chose to live in what was now these public housing projects. And I looked at her and I said, Miss Jones, I said, why do you still stay here? Why do you still live here? And as you can see by now, Ms. Jones has a way of sometimes saying things in threes. So she says to me, why do I still live here? And I said, yes. She goes, why am I still in brick towers and tenant president since 1969? Yes. And why do I still live in apartment 5B? I said, yes. And this woman gets closer to me, stands up tall, short, about a foot shorter than I am. But in that moment, I was looking at a giant. And she says to me, I'm still here because I'm in charge of Homeland Security. The last audacity that this woman showed me is the audacity of love. Love. She took responsibility for her community. She didn't just sit back and wait for someone else. She loved her community and her country so much that she was willing to give her life for it in a battle that some people might think is vain and can't be won. But she believed she could make a difference. This is the nation that I'm willing to fight for. This is the nation you all are fighting for. But this is the kind of love that we still so desperately need. I have unyielding faith in our country, but we have so many challenges. Will our generation prove worthy of the nation we inherited? Will our country realize that those of us who are alive today drank deeply from wells that we did not dig? Will we have the audacity of vision necessary to see our country as it truly is and as it must be? Will we have the tenacity, the sagacity, and the audacity to act in the necessary ways that can draw us all together in common cause above our particularistic differences, above our geographic differences, above our partisan differences, above our religious differences? This great nation that was founded as an experiment. We're not Norway. We're not a homogeneous country. We are America. And will we have the necessary love? Indeed, that's the only real poverty that threatens us. A poverty of love. I call on my friends every day, and even those days I'm too weak to do it myself, to stand up in the way our heroes have, to stand up in the way Miss Jones did, to stand up because people stood for us. They fought for us. They cried for us. They scrubbed toilets for us. They died for us. Will we stand up because, as King said, change will never roll in on the wheels of inevitability. It must be carried in on the backs of soldiers who are willing to fight for it and sacrifice for it. Will we stand up and unleash the truth of who we are on this world? Because Lincoln said it best, every man is born original, but sadly and tragically, most men die copies. Will we stand up? Will we stand up with our courage? Will we stand up with our hope? Will we stand up and remake this country in the image of the divine? Will we see men in prison and women in prison as prodigal children? Will we see our children in school as the only hope we have to secure freedom and democracy in the coming decades? Will we see people laden by disease, whether it be HIV or drug addiction, as folks that are too often marginalized and must be elevated and must be loved? This is our challenge as a nation. This is our calling. We must now decide, where will we go as a country? I am grateful for all you all are doing here in Baltimore. You are a light on the horizon of my city. I'm grateful for the leaders that have come before me who have given me so much in terms of spirit as well as practice. I know where we're going, and I'm grateful that we are together on this journey. God bless you, and God bless America.